Hello and welcome to another episode of the Send Mum Club podcast. I'm Gemma, your host, and if it's your first time listening, welcome. And if it's not your first time and you're a regular listener, then welcome to you as well and thank you. So last week I went to look at a preschool for Leo for the first time. And it was an interesting process. So at the minute, he goes to my friend who is a childminder. So she has just him on his own, which I realise I'm extremely lucky to be able to have that situation for a couple of hours every morning while I work on the radio. And then I pick him up on my way home. But I'm kind of thinking he's three and I don't want to hold him back, I guess, by keeping him at home with me. He's my last baby. So I want him to be with me all the time, if I'm being honest. But I also need to think about what's best for him. So went to look at a preschool, which was gorgeous. It's the first time that I have had to have that conversation about funding and lack of, like, solely in relation to my child. We have this conversation a lot on this podcast and we all know that it's an issue, but it's the first time that it's directly related to me, and somebody has said to me, because of a lack of funding, we might not be able to offer your child something that he may need. And it doesn't feel very nice, does it? In fact, it feels pretty shit. So I am now about to start the process of the EHCP, which I have been putting off for as long as is humanly possible. And I think now's the time. And actually, EHCPs are something that we talk about in this episode. This week, I am joined by Zainab Albarani, and she's been on my wish list actually for a while. I've been following her on Instagram. She is at Chapter 35. I'm sure a lot of you already follow her, and she posts amazing content about autism. So in this chat, we talk about her parenting journey of her two boys who are 10 and 5, who both have autism, and the different ways in which that presents in each of them. We talk about how it feels getting a diagnosis with a second child, and that's a conversation I don't really think I've had too many times on this podcast before. We also talk about regression and how important it is to understand sensory processing. Now, Zainab really knows her stuff. So if you are a mum of a child with autism, I think you're going to find this episode really helpful. But as always, the name of the diagnosis might be different. We've said this a lot, but a lot of the feelings are the same and a lot of the challenges might be the same. So if you're a mum of a child that has a different diagnosis, I do think there's going to be a lot in this episode for you as well. So let's get into it. Zainab, thank you so much for joining me. I'm going to be honest, you've been on my hit list for a little while to get on this podcast because I really, really enjoy the content that you post on Instagram.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
So you are here to talk about your two boys, Yasin and Salim, who are 10 and 5, right?
Yes, that is correct.
And what are they like?
So Yasin is a lot calmer. He is really interested in languages and Pixar and Disney and music. He's very musical. He loves reading, whereas Salim is like the typical second child, just a tornado when he walks into a room. Very chaotic, very funny, very mischievous. He just picked up on things really quickly when he was very little. So yeah, completely different children.
Now, your boys both have autism, don't they? How old were they when you got their individual diagnoses?
Yasin, who's my eldest, he was actually diagnosed at 18 months, which is so young.
Yeah.
It wasn't an official diagnosis, but that's when we spoke to the pediatrician and she was like, yeah, he's definitely autistic. And then obviously we were like thrown into this world where we had absolutely no idea what autism was. We had no family or friends, no connection with it. So it was a completely new world to us. And then from there, you know, we went on the NHS waiting list for speech and language and occupational therapy. And as I'm sure many parents will relate, it just took so long until we could get appointments. So when we really took on like the whole early intervention seriously, and we just wanted to support him as much as possible. And I think looking back, we didn't actually allow ourselves to process the diagnosis as much. And so the grief and all the emotions that come with a diagnosis, they hit later. So when Salim came along, it was really tricky because, like I said earlier, he was hitting a lot of milestones quite early. He had so many words. He was doing things so quickly. And he had a lot of imaginative play as well. So the professionals were just so confused about whether he was autistic or not. You know, he had great eye contact and he was engaging well and so on. But then by the time he turned two or three, it became clear that, yes, he was on the spectrum as well. It just presented very differently from his older brother. And so with Salim, although it was quite difficult to process as well, I feel like we just knew the process. So we were able to support him a lot quicker and a lot more independently.
I think it's a really interesting example of that nature versus nurture, isn't it? Because you've got two boys growing up in the same household and the same family with the same name of a diagnosis, but presenting very differently.
Yeah, and I'm sure, you know, other parents and professionals will relate to this as well, is that when you do, you know, enter the autism world and you start to talk to more people and you go on social media and you follow accounts and you speak to professionals and so on, and just going, you know, about your day, to be honest, I swear, like every week, you know, I bump into someone like a stranger and they'll tell me about, you know, we'll get chatting. They'll tell me like, oh, you know, so-and-so in my family or my friend is, they've got an autism diagnosis. And so you really start to see that actually autism is, it's not like how we used to think of before. We used to think it was just very much like, you know, mild and severe autism. No, a child can present in so many different ways.
Do you feel like there are quite a lot of stereotypes still, or do you think that they are changing? Because I feel like the world is a weird time at the minute, isn't it? I feel like on one hand, we're making these giant steps forwards and there's so much acceptance and understanding and lots of amazing conversations being had. And then on the other hand, being led by America, I feel like we're taking giant steps backwards.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think everyone was quite triggered by that last week. And obviously, just to clarify, you know, there's no truth in it at all. And we know that from research. And I think it's really important that your listeners don't ever put any blame on themselves or anything like that. Like, in my personal experience, I didn't take paracetamol at all, which is what they're claiming in my pregnancies. I honestly think, to answer your question, we are so far behind. Like, we are not doing enough to support autistic children in particular, even adults, to be honest. But my experience is mainly with children. But we're just so behind, and it's so disappointing. And I think I only realized that in the last few years, because I just started to realize, like, we know kids who have an autism diagnosis, or, you know, have additional needs in general, they are not getting supported at schools. We know that. We know the local authorities are not putting them in the right settings. We know that a lot of teachers are just not trained, unfortunately. They can't support these children. We know that a lot of professionals, even their ideas and their practice, is just so behind. Like, when my son got diagnosed, I didn't know anything about autism or speech therapy. And I genuinely went in. I was quite naive, but I think it was quite natural back then. I went in thinking, yeah, just a handful of sessions and he'll get talking and all of that. And oh my God, like, it's not that at all. Like, I didn't know anything about regression and sensory processing and how that impacts autistic children. But the way, like, for instance, and this isn't me disrespecting the NHS. I absolutely love the NHS. And I think there's so many incredible professionals who work there. But the way they go about speech therapy, for instance, is very much supportive of children who are neurotypical. And when it comes to autistic children, we know that a lot of research shows that like 86% of autistic children actually process language in a completely different way. And some people may be familiar with the term Gestalt language processing, which basically isn't practiced at all. Well, there are some, and from what I've seen recently, there are some NHS therapists who are sort of going into it and looking and implementing it with their clients. But most of the NHS therapy is just not geared for autistic children. And therefore, you find that a lot of children end up like constantly hitting a wall when it comes to language development, and they're not progressing. And I found that to be true with my own son, because he was learning language in a very compliant way. So he was learning blocks of language rather than us encouraging him to develop natural language. And so that's just one example, for instance, of how, you know, we're not supporting our children. And the thing is, it's really sad because, like, my kids go to a specialist school and I talk to the teachers and I'm like, do you know about Gestalt language processing? You know, you're dealing with autistic children. And a lot of them don't. And it's like, my kid's there 5 days a week, you know? So, yeah, I think we have a lot to do to catch up. Not to catch up, sorry, a lot to do to support the autism community.
Yeah. I actually had Kirsty Bailey on the episode. I think it'll be, by the time this goes out, it'll be two episodes before this. So if you're listening and you were interested in learning more about Gestalt language processing, me and Kirsty talked quite a lot about that in the episode. And I found that really interesting to learn more about that. But you talking about the school system, am I right in thinking that you had difficulty getting an EHCP?
Yeah, with both the boys. So my eldest got the EHCP, but he wasn't accepted into a lot of schools. And back then, I didn't really know the school system. I didn't know what would be best for him. Eventually, we decided for him to go to a specialist school and he was accepted. But it was such a fight to get him into that specialist school from the local authority. And then with my youngest, it was even worse because even though his brother was diagnosed and was in the specialist school, we thought it would be a lot easier for him to get an EHCP, you know, to get into that school. And we actually found it more difficult. They didn't want to assess him for an EHCP. They completely rejected it. So we had to apply again. And then it took, I think, 2 years of fighting to get him into this specialist school that his older brother attends. And there was no way that I was going to send him to a mainstream. He just wouldn't be able to cope. But yeah, it was very difficult. But I think we got the acceptance like a week before the summer holiday.
God.
Yeah.
So for people who are in the same situation as me with younger children, I am about to start this EHCP process. And quite frankly, I'm terrified because I haven't spoken to anybody who had a smooth process with this. The only people who ended up having a smooth process are people who paid somebody privately to help them. So I do know that that's an option. But if it is, like you said, that the initial application was rejected to assess, when you say that you had to reapply, are you having to change what you're writing? Like, how does that, you know, the reapplication process, for people that don't know, what does that look like?
Okay, so when the youngest, Salim, was at nursery, we knew that we wanted to send him to the specialist school. So the nursery was like to us, I think it just depends what borough you're in. And it's good to like just talk to either the professionals who are working at your child's school or the local borough. Just try and get some contacts and figure out what's going on. With us, the nursery was like, to me, they're actually processing parent referrals a lot quicker for the EHCP assessment. So it's a good idea if you do it. So I went through everything and I sent it in, and that's the one that got rejected. So then the nursery was like, okay, we're going to have to take over. And when they did, they were absolutely incredible. I had such a great team with me. And they filled it in covering every single basis. Like they went through the booklet or the handbook or whatever it is, and they covered every single thing to make sure that the local authority wouldn't come back and say, we're going to reject it again. Like I said, it really depends on what borough you're in and what the system is. So when the second referral went through, the local authority did accept that. But then it was about trying to get him into the specialist school. They were just difficult at every single stage. And you said that there was people you know who have gone privately to get support. And that is unfortunately correct, because a lot of my clients have had to do that as well. They have had to hire private educational psychologists and occupational therapists and speech therapists and get things done privately, and a solicitor. And that's the only way that they've been able to get. And we're talking about a lot of money and energy and parents chasing up every single report and every single stage. Like, honestly, I see the parents who come to our clinic and the ones that have had to fight. Thankfully, they've all been accepted. Their kids have gone to a specialist school, which is really good. But why did they have to go through that process? Like, We've got enough on our plate, us and parents. Why do we have to go through these battles every stage? It's just so frustrating.
Yeah, because really, it's a battle for something that your child is entitled to. You're not fighting for something that actually, you know, they don't really need or they shouldn't have. It's something that process, from everything that I've heard, is a process that really should be as smooth as possible and seems to be quite the opposite. And it's brilliant that there are people there who, you know, if you have the opportunity or the funds to pay for that, it's great that that is an option, but that just isn't an option for a lot of people, is it?
No, it's definitely not. And we're talking about families who, a lot of them are on, you know, single households, like incomes. Some of them are single parents. You know, they're already probably paying for things on extra, like speech therapy or extra resources for their children. But it's just the, like, the mental load and the drain on parents that they have to do this. And I remember feeling so triggered during that time because, I'm sure everyone is familiar with how families with neurotypical children apply for schools. They basically go on the local council, they, you know, put a few options down, and then hopefully you get your first option. In most cases, they probably do. It's like such an easy way that's structured, is so easy and simple, and that's how it should be. But for us, it's so complicated. And so I just think the whole system is just, unfortunately, and we know right now, like, There's a whole crisis right now with the with education.
And I'm assuming that this resistance to offer those places in that setting that is suitable, I'm guessing that that comes down to funding, does it?
Yes, it does. So each child, depending on their needs, will get like a banding with the EHCP. And basically that... they decide on how much funding the child can receive. I remember when my eldest got his EHCP, we got rejected from a lot of mainstream settings because they said, look, the funding that you need and the support that he needs, the banding is just not something that we can support him with. And so that's why it sort of narrowed our options. With my youngest, he also got a certain level of funding that would only have been suitable for a specialist school. But the problem is that there isn't enough specialist schools. There isn't enough places. I know the boys' school is very oversubscribed and they've had to reduce the amount of applications that they accept, which is really sad. And there are people who live in areas where there's no specialist school near them. You know, some of them have to travel like 40 minutes to get somewhere. So, yeah, it's a real struggle for parents.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. This is like, I've definitely been putting it off. We're at a point now where I am going to have to start that process of the EHCP. And I've mentioned before on this podcast, I think I found the DLA incredibly difficult. And by that, I don't mean the writing of it, although it is, you know, it's not an easy form to fill in. I think the emotional impact of getting those reports together and seeing everything written down in black and white and all the different, you know, the different departments that Leo's under, and, you know, a wad this thick of all of the letters that we've ever had from Alder Hey. And I know that the EHCP is that, but ramped up. And yeah, mm-hmm. I'm really not
honestly,
looking forward to that.
The DLA application was, and I'm not trying to overwhelm parents or, you know, to stress you out or anything like that, but this is the reality and it's really sad. And it does, the thing I say to a lot of my clients, I say to them, look, get it done, like start the process earlier, it's better for you, because it can take up to a year or two until you get to that specialist. And a lot of kids have had to repeat a nursery year, so they've had to delay their the start of reception just because they haven't had an acceptance. So the earlier you can get it done, the better.
It's not about scaring, is it? But I think it's definitely for parents of children who are coming up to that age. I think it's good to, what's the phrase? Forewarned is forearmed. I think it's better to know that process isn't going to be smooth sailing and could go on for that long. At least then, you know, everyone's anticipating it to be a difficult process rather than, oh, it's fine, we'll just get the EHCP and then, you know, we'll pick a nice school and that'll be that.
Yeah. And I think it's really important that obviously, you know, starting the process, we're talking about first, you should just go tour as many schools as you can and just see what's suitable. Obviously, not all autistic children or SEND kids go to a specialist school. Some of them can go to the mainstream. Some of them can go to a resource base. There are options out there, which is really important, I think, for us to highlight. But the other thing is really important is that something that I've noticed with a lot of my clients is you really need to make sure you have those updated reports. So make sure that when you are about to apply, you've got speech therapy report, pediatricians, anyone who's involved in your child's care, make sure that they are updated because that is going to be important for you when you're submitting everything.
Okay, that's good advice. Thank you for that. I'd like to just talk about when you got Salim's diagnosis. Well, not necessarily the diagnosis, but when you suspected that he might have autism as well, because I haven't really had this conversation with very many people about a second child getting a diagnosis. I think a lot of the mums I've spoken to so far either have neurotypical children and then have a child with a diagnosis, or they're first time parents. So I'd be interested to know, as a mum, how you felt receiving that diagnosis with your second child.
Yeah, I think there are families out there who have more than one diagnosis, but it is quite rare. I've noticed that as well. And I'll start by saying, I want to tread carefully. I think if you have a neurotypical child and then you have a child who has a diagnosis, whatever that diagnosis is, and I'm genuinely not trying to take away from that diagnosis or what parents go through, you know, it's all valid. But I think if you have a neurotypical child and then you get a diagnosis, I feel like because you've experienced that side of parenting that a lot of parents obviously, and look, I'm being a bit quite vulnerable here, and I want to say this properly. I think because you've experienced that side of parenting that so many parents obviously expect when, you know, they get pregnant and they have children. The second diagnosis, it's not like when you have more than one diagnosis. I don't know if I'm wording this right, but it's like that second diagnosis when we got it, or when we suspected that he was autistic. I can't explain to you the gut-wrenching feeling that we had, where we were just like, oh, like, we're going to have to go through this all over again. And that's not to say, like, we don't love our child, you know, any less or anything like that. Absolutely not. You know, we absolutely love him. He's such a, you know, important person in our family. But it was that grief of knowing that you're not going to experience what everyone else does. Of knowing that you're going to have to go through those battles again, of knowing that, you know, you're going to face regression and you're going to have to take every single step. And when I was pregnant with Salim, part of me was like, you know, I really hope he's going to be neurotypical, because at least, like, you think about the future, you know, like, at least his older brother will have someone. I think that's like a natural, you know, valid, you know, feeling to have as a parent.
100%.
Yeah, you want like to think, okay. But then on the other hand, what was really interesting, and I say this to a lot of people when we have this discussion, I was like, I really hope he's autistic too, because I want them to have, even though like we've said, autism is a spectrum and all of that, I want them to have the same experiences in life. I want them to have the same label. You know, I want them to be able to go to the same school. It's such a weird, and I don't think a parent will ever, ever like adjust to those feelings. It's just constantly going at the back of your head. So that second diagnosis, I think we noticed around his first birthday, because he wasn't interested in his presents and he didn't want to open them. And he didn't want to, there wasn't that excitement that I thought a child would have. And I was like, something's not right here. So from there, we started to really observe. And then we noticed like certain regressions or certain behaviors and things like that. Like I said, it was a bit of a different experience with Salim.
I think what you've said makes total sense, because just a little bit of background on my story. So I have two typical children who are older. So my son Alfie's 17 and Millie's 12. And then I've got Leo, who has Down syndrome, who's 3. But my older two children are with an ex-partner. And me and my husband have Leo together. So mine and my husband Ben's experience of parenting is kind of what you've said. It's different because I have had that experience of, you know, having that in inverted commas, normal experience of parenting, and then have gone on to have a child with a diagnosis where Ben's only child has a diagnosis. And I know he, much like what you said, found that quite difficult, that he wasn't going to experience parenting in the way that he'd anticipated that he would.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I remember, like, you know, when me and my husband have had discussions, he's like to me, I can't experience taking them to a football match or to play football or watch football with them on TV. I can't experience like them, you know, coming to the door when I get home and being all excited that daddy's here. You know, there's just so many things like birthdays and milestones. I know we shouldn't talk about milestones, but I see like a lot of my nieces and nephews, they're starting, you know, they go to birthday parties and they've got friend groups and so many things. And I feel that pinch every single time. And sometimes I think to myself, shouldn't it get easier as they're getting older because I'm used to the experience? And in some aspects, that's true. But honestly, it's been 10 years and I still get triggered sometimes and I still have those moments. And I see kids moving on and doing things and learning new skills and having those experiences, and we're still trying to learn basics, you know? And sometimes when they do learn that basic, it's so rewarding. But on the other hand, yeah, it's just, it's a lot of emotions. And I don't feel like it gets easier as they get older.
I think in some ways, I mean, Leo's only three, so I haven't really experienced that. But this is something that I'm extremely aware of. I almost feel like I might find it harder as he gets older, because I think it's, for me, I don't know if you're the same, I try not to look into the future too much because that feels like a scary place to go. Through therapy, I've found it easier to do that, but I still try and stay as present as I can in a nice, safe space where I know what things look like. But I think when I do look towards the future, that's something that I find triggering to think about, is that kind of comparison when he's older. I feel like it's less when they're small and they're cute and, you know, they're like, you know, crawling around or, you know, whatever milestones your child might be hitting. They're sitting up, they're learning to clap. It almost feels easier when they're like a baby or a toddler rather than, I don't know, it puts my head into a different place when I think about those comparisons, say, in teenage years.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, because, you know, when you drop them off at nursery, for instance, you see the other kids and, you know, or when you're having family gatherings and things like that, and you're like, oh, he's three, it's okay. Like, there are other kids who are probably not talking as much, or
exactly
there are
that.
Other kids who are not toilet trained. They're only three, it's fine.
Yeah, yeah.
But when your child gets to like 8 or 9 or 10 or whatever, and you know, I'm sure loads of parents will relate to this, and they're not doing those basic skills, and then other kids, like I it's so funny because I feel like parents, and I think you could write a booklet about where parents could get triggered. Like, I get triggered when I go to Smith's, the toy store, because I go into those aisles and I know that kids at like 10 start to get into Spider-Man and things like that. And I'm like, oh, but, you know, we're still watching like In the Night Garden. And they say a lot, it's, you know, a child who's autistic, their brain obviously is completely different the way it's wired. But things like that trigger me, you know, and birthday parties. And I also found that the other thing, you know, going off birthday parties is like when we were younger, they used to have their birthday parties with their cousins. And now their cousins are older, so they have their birthday parties with their friends that they've made, you know, their little groups in school. And so my kids don't get invited to things like that now because my niece is having it with her little, you know, her little girlfriends. And that makes sense. But it's just like, you know, I don't know. Like my eldest, he's in year six now. So he's got just this year, and then he goes to high school. And I'm not dealing with it well at all. Like, when I think about how fast time is going,
The
fact that he's in high school, like, what is the future going to hold for him? And like you, I really do try and just take one day at a time. But it's just a valid experience as parents.
Yeah, 100%. And I think it's hard, like, having experienced both sides of that. I think it's a difficult thing having those transitions with a typical child. I found it really difficult when both of my older children started high school because it feels like such a huge transition and such a huge milestone in their life. But then adding on everything else that you're going to be thinking about with a child with any kind of diagnosis, that's going to mean that that transition is more challenging. It's just, yeah, it's a lot, isn't it?
Is, yeah. I mean, I feel like I just want to scream at the school. I'm like, we're not ready. Like, just keep him in year six. And we're not ready for this at all. But yeah, it's a lot.
You've mentioned a couple of times the word regression, and I've seen on your Instagram, you've just done a post about regression. And is that with Salim?
Yes, it is. So I experienced it with both. But yeah.
Could we talk about that, please?
Yeah. So regression, it's very common in autistic children. We can't pinpoint exactly what the reason is, but from observation, experience and research, there could be a number of factors. For instance, the child has just been really unwell for a certain period of time. There's a big life-changing, altering, you know, event going on in their life. Some sort of transition, like transitioning into school or something like that. But it could also be the child being very overwhelmed because of their sensory system. And that's what I'm experiencing with Salim right now. I'm very, very sure that that's the reason. He goes through periods of time where his sensory needs are too overwhelming for him, and they impact his nervous system and therefore it impacts his day-to-day life. And so a child whose sensory system is not, you know, level to what we ideally want, it's going to impact their skills. And one of them is their speech. So when he was younger, he had a lot of vocab. He could label everything. Like, he'd come into the kitchen when I was cooking and he'd be like, tomatoes, potatoes, aubergine, everything. He'd be saying it to himself. I knew that. He wasn't necessarily saying these things for a social conversation with me, but he had so much language. And I know the language is still there, but we go through these periods of time where he's very overwhelmed, and we're trying to support him as best as possible. One of my areas of expertise is sensory integration. Something I'm very, very passionate and interested about, because it wasn't something I knew about when my eldest was diagnosed. And we are trying to support him. It's tricky. It's not easy. And I know a lot of parents will probably be like nodding along if they heard this, because every day is different and you don't know where the triggers are coming from. Sometimes the trigger is his older brother. So you can imagine, like, being in a household like that, it's just difficult. And so he has regressed, and we have gone through these phases with him. The recent one is that we haven't really heard his voice over the summer, and it's been really difficult. Like, I'm not going to lie to you. Like, I say, like, you know, it doesn't get easier when they get older. But in the last few years, I've really tried to protect, like, my mental health and my well-being and my overall outlook on how, you know, I see our life right now. And I've been trying to put things in place to really support our needs as a family. But this has hit hard in the last few months, because when I sit down and think and I look at videos of him when he was younger, one of the videos I uploaded on Instagram, and I'm just like, you know, I heard your voice all the time, but now you're babbling, and this regression, it's really difficult. And I have to keep reminding myself that he's going to get there, because I know from my eldest, we went through exactly the same thing. And he's now, you know, I wouldn't say having full on conversations, but he's producing a lot more natural language, which is amazing. And yeah, it's tough. Regression is really difficult, and parents will experience it in so many different areas. You know, you could toilet train your child and then they'll regress for whatever reason, you know. There is this whole graph that talks about regression. I can't remember exactly where it's like, but I think parents will relate and understand what I mean, is that sometimes when children regress, actually when they come back and relearn the skill again, they've actually advanced. And I really noticed that with my eldest. I think it's really important for parents is not to grieve too much, like, recognize your feelings, and obviously they're very valid, but just know that, just have that hope, you know, and continue to give that consistent support for your child, because they will learn it again, especially if it's a skill that they really mastered.
I'm interested to know, because obviously, and you've referenced this a few times, I think it's really impressive, I'd like to say, that you came into this world of autism with Yacine, and you said that you didn't know anything. And I was the same. I knew nothing about Down syndrome. I'd never met anybody that had Down syndrome. I literally had zero knowledge. And I think it's really impressive that you've gone literally from zero to 100. I mean, obviously not quickly. It's obviously been a process for you. But I really admire that you have now got all of this knowledge and you're using that to help other people. But I am interested to know, because you do that for a job now, do you ever find that it's overwhelming? Because I suppose when you're at home with your children, that is your life with your children who have autism. And a lot of people would be able to go to work, or if they were able to work, whilst looking after their children. And I would imagine that that can be a bit of an escape to go, okay, I don't need to think about it for a while. I can switch off. Where you can't do that. How, because obviously you referenced your mental health there. How do you find that affects you?
Like I said, it's been 10 years. It's been a journey, you know? And I come from a Middle Eastern background, and I was the first person in my community to openly talk about autism, like no one else. Even if they did have autistic children, no one talked about it because it was a bit of a taboo. Yeah. It's changed a lot. We're very, very open about it, especially like our generation. We have events, we have charities, we have organizations, you know, podcasts, interviews. People want to learn, they want to change. And it's incredible. It's really incredible to see like the progress that our community has had in the last, like I'd say 5 to 10 years. But yeah, I remember 10 years ago, like I wrote an article for an online magazine. And from there, I hadn't even told anyone. It was just like direct family. I didn't even tell friends and family because I really wanted to process that diagnosis. And then I openly talked about it. And honestly, the community was incredible. They were so supportive. And from there, I decided to open my Instagram page. So I started talking about it openly from there, you know, giving people a platform to just relate to what our life was like. And then also people obviously slip into your DMs and like ask you questions and things like that. So it became, you know, and as a parent, obviously you do your own research and you read and you're interested in all of that. And then it got to a point where I was just like, oh, you know what, I think I could do this, you know, like I could be a valuable asset to the community and you know, the wider society if I learn. And the reason why I really wanted to do it is because, and I think it's so important if your listeners are interested as well as parents, you've got all that lived experience, you know, as a parent. You are like, you know so much about your children. And you can offer so much as well. And I think it's so important. And when our clients come to the clinic, they can relate to me because they'll talk about what's going on with their child at home. And we can offer more than just that professional support. It's also that emotional connection as well that we can give the parent. And so I think it's really important. And so I trained as an autism consultant and then as a speech and language associate practitioner. And so I work for Happy Chatters. And I have my own company as well, Chapter 35. And I started by just doing online workshops. And there's so much out there, you know, that you can learn from. So many professionals out there who offer their services and, you know, they do workshops and things like that. Like you can literally learn from home and build yourself up. And then, you know, if you're looking to give back to that community, then do it. And you said about, is it overwhelming? It's very overwhelming. I'm not going to lie to you. It's very overwhelming, but also it's so rewarding. So I work on a Saturday as well, and I see my clients. And, you know, the day goes by really quickly, and it's such a joy to see them and to see the progress that they're making. So incredible. I get home, and I just feel like my brain is just like, oh, my God. And the kids are like skimming and, you know, they're probably having their own meltdown or they're just really loud and excited to see me. And so on those days, yeah, I'm just like, I really need to just shut down my brain and just sit in a quiet room. But the positive of it is so much more. It just outweighs it, definitely, because you can see these families. You know, there were kids that I've seen for like over a year now, and they started off with me and they weren't talking, and now they do. You know, they've got lots of language and they're communicating. I think I shared something the other week as well, the little boy who came to me, and it's just absolutely incredible. And then we're also doing work in education settings as well. So we're going to nurseries and schools, and so we can provide that support for the professionals as well. I just think it's, you know, it's full circle. You know, everyone's giving their little bit, and it's important.
I completely agree. I just think it's so interesting the way that life takes you to go from this is now your whole life and you're doing amazing things, where 11 years ago, this wouldn't have even crossed your mind as to this is where you would be now. And I find that really interesting.
And I'd add to that, when my eldest got his diagnosis, those first few years were really difficult. And I actually didn't want to learn a lot because I felt like it was really overwhelming and triggering. So in my spare time, you know, parents will probably be similar. You know, you often research things or you watch videos and things like that. Or people would send me things like, oh, look at this video, you might find it interesting. And I'd just be like, no, thank you, because I've just dealt with a whole day with my son and it's been really challenging. I don't want to learn, you know? And that wasn't in a disrespectful way. It was just like, this is so overwhelming right now. And I think a lot of parents, if you're going through those first few years post-diagnosis, just know that it's really natural. It's so natural to just want to just focus on your child and go through the motions and just get through day by day.
Yeah, I think it's important to note that, actually, isn't it? Because that's fine if you aren't ready to do the deep dive and the learning and the reading and maybe an online course, you know, whatever that would look like for you. I think once you enter this world of SEND, it's very important, or it certainly has been for me, and I think other people will relate, to take things at your own pace. Don't feel like you should be doing something because somebody else is, or because somebody's gone, oh, look, you could be doing this, or have you thought about this? Like, you can do it when they're, depending on a diagnosis, you could do it when they're 6 months or 6 years. It's important to take everything at a pace that you're comfortable with, isn't it?
Definitely. I remember those first few years, we'd spend hours at night just sitting there reading and reading and reading, and it was just so bad for our mental health. But I do think the world's changed since my son got diagnosed. Like, when I actually started my Instagram page, honestly, there was probably a handful of other pages out there that were talking about autism, not even professionals, just parents, you know? And so I think the world has changed so much that now we're very lucky that we can just open our phone, go onto social media, see these things, that the content that professionals or families are putting up there, and learn from them and connect with people as well, which I think is so important. Because in those early years, it was so isolating to be a parent of an autistic child. Now, you know, it's incredible. There's a wonderful community out there.
100%. I feel exactly the same, because that is the place, Instagram, I mean, where I found my first tiny glimmers of hope when Leo was born and we got his diagnosis. Because, again, I'm sure everybody has felt like this at some point. I was like, this is dreadful. This is like the end. We're never going to be happy again. It's the worst thing that could have happened. I will say, obviously, I don't feel like that now, but I think you go through those emotions. You mentioned grief, and it is a form of grief, isn't it? You go through anger and why me and all of those negative emotions. And I can't imagine what it would have been like had social media not been a thing, because like you said, I was able, when I was ready, to pick up my phone and start looking for those accounts and finding people where I was like, oh, okay, they look like they're actually having a nice life. They're doing things that I want to do with my child, and it isn't just this pit of doom.
Yeah, definitely. No, you're right.
Obviously, social media gets a bad rap, and rightly so in some cases. But I think it's really nice to see that really positive sense of community and support that you can get. It's nice to see the flip side of social media, isn't it, in such a positive way.
also to see that other people are probably experiencing the same thing you are as well. When you're having a challenging time, seeing other people that are also openly speaking about this, it's so relatable. And even though there's so many incredible professionals out there, I bet parents go on social media and they relate more to obviously these other parents who are going through the same journey as them.
100%. And I remember the very first person I messaged. And it does feel quite scary, doesn't it, to reach out to a stranger on Instagram and go, oh, you don't know me, but I've just had this diagnosis that you're posting about. And to kind of feel that comfort was huge for me. And then I can't remember who it was, but somebody messaged me the other day on Instagram and said that my account was the first one that they saw after they got their diagnosis of Down syndrome. And she said it made it like that, the same thing I've just said, that it gave her that little bit of hope that actually things were going to be okay. And I feel like it's such a lovely feeling to pass that on. And then those people pass that on. And like you said, I think it definitely, you relate a hell of a lot more.
A lot of families as well, but you know, they don't have someone in their inner circle who is going to be able to understand. Like in our family, we're the only ones who have autistic children. And so who do I turn to, you know? And I'm very, very happy that I've now found my village. You know, like there are the SEND mums at school, or there are the SEND mums in our community, or the SEND mums online. And it is really important to find that community, because they're the ones who are just going to get it.
100%. And it's important to have those people, isn't it, where you're not having to kind of explain what things mean, or they're trying to make you feel better by just going, no, don't worry, it'll be fine. Because I think sometimes people just want to say something positive and nice, but they don't know what to say unless they get it.
No, definitely. Yeah, we've experienced that as well.
So I finish the podcast in the same way each time by asking the same two questions. And the first one of those questions is, what's the best piece of advice that you've been given along your journey as a SEND mum?
So look, early intervention, I think, is really, really important for these children, because a child's brain is like a sponge, you know, when they're younger. They're going to absorb so much more. And a lot of, that's not to say when they get older, you know, they can't, you can't support them. No, of course not. But those early years are really crucial. And I think it's really important to just be able to reach out to the right people, professionals, to support your child. But like we said earlier, is to take it at your pace. Do not overwhelm yourself at all. And I think that's really important, because a lot of families, especially, you know, it is changing, but a lot of people from my own community, for instance, sometimes they just bury their head in the sand and just ignore it all and just hope, you know, things will change naturally. So, yeah, advice wise, I would say try and get, you know, those early years, the support that the child needs is really good, but also support for you as a parent. And when in those early years, we were going through some really challenging times with my eldest. It was so difficult and overwhelming. And I remember going to a course. It was by a charity called Parenting Special Children. And there were two professionals there who were also parents of neurodivergent children. So it was really lovely to just speak to them and just like have, like we've been talking about a lot in this podcast, like being able to relate to them. And we were talking, I think the session was about mental health and like how to support yourself as a parent. And I remember them saying, it's really important to do small acts of like kindness to yourself that's going to make you feel better. And I literally put my hand up and I was like, sorry, with all due respect, what's the point? Because if I do all these little things, what's the point if I go home and my child is having a massive meltdown, you know, for over an hour, that's going to drain all of my energy? And I remember, I think I was like crying when I was asking this question, because we were going through like a terrible time. And they were like, trust me, it's important, because you need those pockets of space. You need those pockets of like well-being. And honestly, I'll give that advice 100% now, because when I started to practice that, I really noticed the difference. So I was a big emotional eater. So whenever we were having a bad day, I would just go to the kitchen and just sit there and just cry and just, you know, stuff my face. And then I realized, you know what? if I'm actually feeding my body with the right things and hitting the gym, then I'm going to feel better in myself, even though we're having a crap day at home. If I make sure that I plan to see, you know, friends who generally, you know, like, are a positive impact in my life, like friends who genuinely, you go see them, you're just going to laugh all evening. If I make sure I go see them like every so often, that's going to be really helpful for me. If I, like, I love reading. If I read and I just find that escapism in books, then again, that's going to be another thing that's going to really help me. So those little things, really, over time, it really made an impact, because if we were having a crap day, I wouldn't feel like overly rubbish, because I know that I've, you know, done something for myself that has really helped my own well-being. And trust me, in practice, I know it's easier said than done, but in practice, if you can find anything that brings you that pocket of joy, then do it, because over time, you're going to notice the difference to your well-being.
That's great advice. I really like that. And my other final question is, what do you know now that you wish you'd known when you got that initial diagnosis, either of them?
Parents of autistic children, go research about sensory processing, because it's so important. So many of us go into a diagnosis and we're like, right, well, our kids are not talking, so the first thing we need to do is make sure that they're talking, and then that will solve all of our problems. And actually, I wish I could go back and tell myself, no, go research sensory processing and how important it is to your child's nervous system. Because if your child is regulated, then all those other skills that you want to work on are going to help you so much more to support them. A child who is dysregulated is not going to be able to speak. Their language is just going to drop completely, their language skills. They're not going to be able to have that attention skills that you want. They're not going to be able to have that connection and engagement that you want. They're just not going to be happy overall. And we want to support their overall well-being. But I wish I could go back and prioritize sensory processing or sensory regulation over speech.
Zainab, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I've really enjoyed talking to you. But before you go, if people aren't already following you, where can they find you and how can people connect with you?
Okay, so my Instagram page is chapter 35. That's all words. And I also have a website where I offer online workshops covering all sorts of topics relating to autism. And I also work for a company called Happy Chatters. We do have an Instagram account as well. If you are in the London or Berkshire area, then we do have two clinics available where we can support your child one-to-one.
And I'll make sure that the links for all of the things that you've just said are in the show notes, because I know it's, you know, sometimes it's a bit chaotic when you're listening to something, isn't it? And you haven't got a pen or whatever, and it's easier for it. So if you need those links, they will be in the show notes. And Zainab, thank you so much for taking the time to chat to me.
Thank you. I really appreciate you listening to me and having me on the show.
What an interesting chat. I really enjoyed that. I mean, I said it to her, but I just think it's so interesting and impressive how Zainab went from really no knowledge on autism whatsoever 10 or so years ago to now clearly having done a lot of learning and research and really knowing her stuff and using that to help other parents. And I think I'm always so impressed by women, well, people, but obviously women I'm speaking to on this podcast, who do that, who take that knowledge that they've acquired, level it up, and then use it to help other people in the same situation. I just think that's a wonderful thing to do. If you aren't already, make sure you're following Zainab on Instagram, because I think the content that she's posting about autism is brilliant. It's really positive, it's really helpful, and I also think a lot of the stuff that she posts would be really useful to pass on to friends and family if you have an autistic child. Like, there was a post that I really liked recently, and it was about things to say to a mom who had just received a diagnosis of autism. And I think posts like that sometimes, if you pass them on to people, it just helps with that kind of, like we mentioned in the episode, I think a lot of times people want to help, but they don't know what to say, or they're scared of saying the wrong thing. So I think some of her content is definitely super helpful for you if you are the mum of an autistic child, or to pass on to people around you in your circle to help them understand, I guess. So that's it for another episode of the Send Mum Club. I really hope you enjoyed listening to that chat as much as I enjoyed having it. As always, I would love it if you would rate, subscribe, review, whatever it is that you can do to interact with this podcast. Again, if you would like to slide into my DMs to give some guest suggestions, if you'd like to suggest yourself, I've had loads of people on now who've suggested themselves. And sometimes those episodes end up being some of the best ones and some of the most interesting ones. So I'm definitely up for that. I am at the Send Mum Club on Instagram if you aren't already following. I would love to hear from you. And I'll be back same time next week with a brand new episode for you.